The nuclear energy debate is not a new one to SACPAW. Many of you who follow our sessions know that we had a session on nuclear energy in the Alberta tar sands by Cosmos Voutsinos over a year ago now. And that was about using nuclear energy as a source for tar sands development. We also had Marlo Reynolds from the Pembina Institute talking about the emerging energy and environment challenges, including the environmental and economic risks of nuclear energy in Alberta and in Canada generally. And just last fall, Eric Williams was here from the Canadian Nuclear Society, and he talked about living and working near the Bruce Nuclear Power Station. Our speaker today is Dr. Jim Harding, and he's worked, dare I say, several decades with nuclear energy issues in our country. He's a retired professor of environmental and justice studies, a founding member of the Regina Group for the Non-Nuclear Society and the International Uranium Congress. And he was director of research for Prairie Justice Research at the University of Regina, where he headed up a project called the Uranium Inquiries Project. Jim has also acted as Prairie Court correspondent for Nuclear Free Press, and he was consultant to a National Film Board award-winning film entitled Uranium. His book, Canada's Deadly Secret, Saskatchewan Uranium and the Global Nuclear System, was published in October of 2007, and it's available for sale after the session outside the room there. And from Michelle. The proceeds will be going to, Michelle is there, the proceeds will be going to Kairos, the Council of Canadians, and the Lethbridge Network for Peace. So if you feel inclined, do pick up a copy of Jim's book. Jim's been traveling across the country. He's been able to make a diversion to Lethbridge, for which we're really fortunate. And I'd like you all to join me in welcoming Jim today.
Well, first of all, my apologies for enabling this sort of rushed discussion. My instincts would be to stay here tonight and continue the discussions from last night. And I have to speak at Calgary tonight, and I'd like to pretend it's tomorrow, but actually the Calgary meeting I think is going to be quite significant because I'm going to try to encourage Alberta people to take the lead now in remaking Canadian energy policy. And doesn't that sound strange? But I'm now convinced, pretty much, after traveling since November, and I haven't been to the East Coast yet, but I've been everywhere from Quebec to BC. I'm convinced that what this really is all about is that Canada doesn't exist yet, that it's a figment of our imagination. The retreating process, the creating of a sustainable energy policy, doing settlements and economic activities in sustainable ways is clearly what we have to do now. And the dialectic is interesting because this is where the backlash to the National Energy Program started this whole Reform Alliance Harper minority government. So now it seems to me another story in Canadian history can begin to be made. And it ought to come from here because, of course, the tar sands is that's the end of the old story. And across the border in Saskatchewan, the uranium mines is the end of the old story. That would be the story of the non-renewable industrial society that's not sustainable. And of course, we're wedded now, Saskatchewan and Alberta, with all our political and historical differences, we're on the same watershed, and we're the front end now of the non-renewable energy systems. We're the front end for the uranium and the nuclear system in Saskatchewan, and you're now the reason why Canada is the single largest source of imported oil from the United States over and above Saudi Arabia. So this is like our challenge. Now I'm looking around and saying, okay, so we're all close to the end of our lives here. Not everybody. I like talking to the 20-year-olds who are active in the PIRGs and stuff, because this has got to be an intergenerational project. We have to do this together. But the question is, what are those of us who are getting closer to the end of our lives going to do about this sustainability project? And we have a big job to do as grandparents. And I hope none of you stop working on this, because your lives will be more fulfilled. Your intergenerational commitments will be strengthened. And we'll all go on new learning curves, including about rebuilding our communities, rebuilding our families, and all of that. So I'm looking around, I'm saying, okay, so if there's one thing I want to say to you, it's those of us who are having a bit more time to focus, we have one of the important jobs to do now. Okay? And I think that's true. The raging grannies, for sure. But don't think for a moment that retirement is an opportunity to drop out. Because it's really an opportunity to reengage. And I know when I worked full-time and had young children and took care of my parents as they aged, that I couldn't do this work. And it was all important work. But I also know my parents would be glad that I'm up here, that I took the time to do this. Well, I haven't got much time, clearly, and what's this all about, this notion that nuclear power is a fix for climate change? That it's clean, that it's safe, that it's peaceful, and that it's economic. Therefore, promotional points. Well, it's balderdash. It's total, complete balderdash when it's systematically studied. And it's an indication of how our worldviews get shaped through repetition of non-evidence-based assertions. And evidence-based assertions matter. I just spoke to doctors, and they were hardcore epidemiologists, and they were watching me closely when I talked about environmental health and the nuclear fuel cycle. And I really appreciated them demanding that I argued my case carefully, because I wanted them on side in the coalition. And they are. They're going public in Ottawa, the Physicians for Global Survival. They're affiliated with the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1985. And that group's coming on side now with the Coalition for a Uranium Moratorium in the Ottawa Valley. And this is an important breakthrough in Canada, because the Algonquin and the settlers and the cottage people in that Mississippi watershed are now talking to each other to protect the water basin. They haven't talked to each other, some of them, for 100 years. This is a significant shift. The doctors are coming on side now and saying there should be a complete ban on uranium mining in these watershed areas. The Grand Canyon, the legislation is now being considered to have a complete ban on all uranium mining in the Grand Canyon watershed, because uranium tailings have already polluted aquifers from the mines from the 50s and the 60s. In Colorado, in Port Hope, there's an aquifer that's contaminated underneath the plant the Cameco runs. When I was there, we were monitoring how far as the radioactivity moved into the watershed. It's time to wake up that what's under the ground and what's in the air is the future, that we have to protect water sources, whether they're visible to us or not, and that we can't continue to treat Mother Earth as a garbage dump. And radioactive contaminants may be invisible, unlike sulfur dioxide and coal, but they are contaminants. And so we've got to be thoughtful about this and not just rely on our nose or our eyes. For sure, when you compare a coal-fired plant that produces electricity to a nuclear power plant that protects, creates electricity, you're going to see more soot out the one than the other. You're not going to see the tritium, which is a carcinogen, that goes into Lake Ontario through the cooling process. Canada's the largest producer of tritium on the planet because tritium is an inherent byproduct of the CANDU process. Uses heavy water for cooling. Tritium's radioactive hydrogen. It's what happens after the fission process, and it inevitably ends up in the coolant stream that goes into the lakes. In Ontario, the water quality standards for tritium have never been health standards, because if they were, they'd have to shut the CANDUs down. So right now, they just lowered tritium to 7,000 becquerels a liter from 40,000 becquerels a liter, and the U.S. is still 10 times lower than ours. And why can't they take it down to the levels that Europe's had for 20 years or the U.S. has had for 20 years? Because we can't probably meet those standards with the expansion of the CANDUs on the Great Lakes, because tritium is an inherent byproduct of the CANDU fission process. So what are our standards about? Our radon standards in Canada have been 800 becquerels a cubic meter of air, when all of the international research has said that level is carcinogenic. That level allows excess lung cancers. Radon gas, the second highest cause of lung cancer on the planet after smoking. Why have our standards been high? Because we have mines. We are the front end of the nuclear system. It would be a challenge to the economics of the industry. We've just pulled it down to 200 becquerels a cubic meter of air, which is where the U.S. has been since 1986, lower. My calculations is that since about a third of the cancers could have been prevented by lowering that level, that there's about 13,000 excess lung cancers in Canadians in the last 20 years as a result of us not having health standards for radon exposure. Okay? This is all in a document that you can sign up for if you want outside. There's a document on the health issues, there's a document on Ontario energy policy, and then there's a document on Alberta, because I have traveled up to Peace River as well. So a lot of this is in those emails. So it's not clean when you actually think about it. It's radioactive. Plus the carbon footprint of nuclear power, when you look at the full fuel cycle, is just barely behind coal. And as the quality of uranium comes down, in so many words, as we require more low-grade mining for uranium, the carbon footprint goes up because you have to do more hard rock mining, and that's an extremely intensive fossil fuel activity. We're already short of uranium. The high-grade sources like Cigar Lake in northern Saskatchewan, that was supposed to provide 17% of the world market, it's flooded. The whole underground system is flooded. Which is, and the investors are getting impatient because they're going to need another several hundred millions to try to build even better doors to keep Mother Nature's water out of the pits. That's the reason why they're mining in Ontario, in the Ottawa Basin, is because the bull market's so high, the supply is potentially not there, and we're talking about expanding this industry to deal with the climate change crisis. My God, we'll be wrecking watersheds all over the planet for the low-grade ore. It's a totally irrational scheme, and anyway won't deal with the climate change carbon greenhouse gas issue. It's certainly a danger to environmental health, whether it's the radon gas that's made more bioavailable. Uranium, of course, is a natural element, but you mine it and you mill it and you crush it, and you create this flour-like tailing product that has some elements like thorium that have a half-life of 76,000 years, which means that thorium will produce radium, which will produce radon gas forever, and bioavailable in terms of the ecosystems and the aquifers and the food chain. So you're basically spreading this rather than leaving it in a much less accessible system. The tritium, of course, in the Great Lakes. The International Joint Commission that oversees the health of the Great Lakes has said tritium is a candidate for zero emission. Zero emission. Because it is a carcinogen. And we shouldn't be putting tritium into the Great Lakes. Period. It's a short-term way and a toxic way to create electricity when there are all kinds of more economic available options for doing that, which I'll talk about in a minute. So the clean, I'm sorry, that doesn't work. The safe, not at all. We now know from a rash of studies in England, Germany, and France, the best one done by the Germans in the last year, full analysis of all childhood cancers in the German database, and then analysis by proximity to nuclear facilities. I think we know without any much doubt now that children who grow up in the radius of the nuclear facilities, whether that's nuclear power plants, reprocessing plants, or conversion plants, are at much higher risks of fatal leukemia. Not surprising in terms of what we know about how radioactivity works and how children's growth and development works. It's a price I'm not willing to pay, but the industry denies that that's, in fact, a cost at all. Most Canadians don't yet know about the public health consequences of uranium mining because we've never studied it. We've never studied the public health consequences of uranium. We've had a few studies of the occupational health consequences. The Ham Commission on Uranium Mining in 1976 in Ontario showed 4 to 5 times the expected lung cancer among uranium workers. So we kind of know that. But the public health we've never looked at. Well, they just did a study in India of the villagers who live in the radius of the uranium mines, tailings, and mills.
What radius?
They're within 5 kilometers. They've compared those villagers to villages who are 35 or 40 kilometers away from the mine sites. And on all key indicators, statistically significantly higher congenital deformation, death by birth defects, death by a number of cancers, permanent sterility, and most interestingly, shortened lifespan. The communities around the mines have higher indicators of education and economic status, i.e. they fit the model of economic development that is promoted by the non-renewable energy sector, whether it's tar sands or uranium or whatever. In so many words, this is what globalization, the message of globalization is, we're all going to be better off if we all spread and participate in this form of energy and economic growth, but the actual studies show the people in the villages with lower status in terms of education and economic standing live longer and are healthier. It's not a surprise. in terms of what we know about radiation and biology. So that will be the study that the physicians will release in Ottawa next week, and they'll pose the question, why are Canadians not aware, being the front end of the whole nuclear system, the biggest producers of uranium, about the growing knowledge about the environmental health consequences of the spread of the nuclear fuel system? And I think the answer is clear. We all know it's taken hundreds of years for us to get police, prosecutors, and judges or juries to be separate enough that we can have some confidence that there could be due process and a reasonably the possibility of some understanding of what happened when a crime goes through the legal process. And we know there's colonial and systemic discrimination in that system. There's been gender discrimination. There's certainly class and poverty discrimination, and that's the field I worked in for 30 years. But we know it's taken hundreds of years to try to democratize that system, and that we still have to watch it very closely. Well, the environmental protection, health protection, and the regulatory system around the nuclear fuel cycle is like the legal system was in the Middle Ages. And that's the reality. The collusion within that system makes it untrustworthy. People go back and forth between the promoting and the regulatory bodies, and the health data population studies, so often they coffee together, they have a worldview, they promote it, they're in denial about the science that's emerging around the risks of low-level radiation and about alternatives to nuclear for electrical generation. And it's going to take the public, us, to make this part of our task of making that a democratic system, making that a credible system, separating those authorities. They're all under the same ministry federally. Think about that, Minister of Energy and Mines, the regulators, the promoters, the owners, etc. That would be ACL, ACB, or the new Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission, and Health Canada. Now, their population studies about risks of people who are are along the nuclear fuel cycle are no basis for assessing actual risks for local populations, and everybody knows that who studies epidemiology. You have to do a local specific dose response study to make these connections. We're not doing them. Port Hope, 1975, they found the radon gas was 125 times the allowable level, which, by the way, was four times higher than it should have been, on a playground in the elementary school. Parents didn't even know that this was happening with their children. Of course they got upset. We want to protect our children. They hadn't even been informed that this has been the level of the background, so-called background, from 75 years now of radioactive conversion or radioactive contamination. They were promised a study in 79, never happened. They were promised one in 1997, never happened, because they don't want to do it. So they just hired their own lab. I call it citizen science. They had a lab come in. Nine people gave them urinalysis. They sent them off to a credible lab in Germany that actually does natal research on Gulf syndrome and depleted uranium. What did they find? They found all those nine people in their bodies are carrying the man-made uranium isotopes of depleted uranium, uranium-236, which is a spent fuel, and uranium-234, which is an enriched uranium. These are not uranium-238 byproducts from natural uranium. Some of these products, actually, the El Dorado and Cameco were never licensed to even work with in Cameco or in Port Hope. The body doesn't lie. So Health Canada said, no problem, everybody has this in their body. Not true. This is not uranium-238. So the physics and the chemistry people who are independent of the collusion are going to work with the local people, and we're trying to get a medical team to go in and do some clinical studies. This is just down lake from Toronto, folks. This is in the Golden Horseshoe. These are not First Nations people. But as a friend said to me in northern Saskatchewan 2 years ago, he said, Jim, we're going to all be Indians. We're all going to be Indians. We're all going to be on the front end. And of course, we know that it has been First Nations who have been in the areas of high contamination and radioactivity around the uranium mines, the Lakota, the Navajo in the States, the Cree and the Dene, and the Serpent River Band in Northern Ontario. And they've been the recipients of the waste of the non-renewable high-energy industrial system all over the planet when you actually start to look at how things are done. But now, it's Ottawa, Kingston, the Rideau Lakes, rich cottagers who have got to get their heads around this, that water matters and we have to find an alternative way to produce electricity. Now, it's also said it's peaceful. And this is the tough one, because I bought into it. When they expanded the mines in the late 70s, we thought the issue of the weapons connection was not an issue we had to deal with. We thought the Non-Proliferation Treaty was giving us some guarantee that at least this uranium, still a problem in terms of spent fuel, still a problem in terms of the radioactivity along the nuclear fuel chain, but maybe not a problem in terms of weapons proliferation. We were wrong. We're still in the weapons stream. And this is how it happens. Non-proliferation treaty just says you can't sell your uranium and have it enriched to go directly into the military weapons stream. It doesn't say you can't sell your uranium, which they enrich, to get uranium-235 up to the level they need for the light water reactor in the United States or France, and then leave 9/10 of the volume in depleted uranium, because only 1/10 of it goes into the enrichment stream. It doesn't say that can't be then used for other purposes. And under both the Free Trade Agreement and a number of U.S. legislation, once it is enriched in the United States, it is considered of domestic origin. And they take it and produce weapons. And AKT, the company, wants to buy Canada Arm, and there's such a backlash now in BC, including in conservative constituencies, which is a good sign. That company that wants to buy the Canada Arm, which, by the way, $400 million of public money went in to produce a so-called peaceful exploration of space technology. That company is the largest producer of depleted uranium weapons on the planet. So there you go. There's our future. What are we doing this for? And are we going to be bought up by the military-industrial system? Or are we going to put our foot down and say, no, Canada really wants to be part of making a peaceful and sustainable world? So we're in the weapons stream, and I say a little bit of Saskatchewan's in every little depleted uranium bomb that went off in Baghdad or Afghanistan, and the childhood cancer stats are 5 to 7-fold up now. And it's inevitable because alpha-emitting particles are getting into people's bodies and lungs. So there's a conscience question, there's an international law question, there's an ultimate war crimes question, because we know under international law that indiscriminate killing of people who are not combatants is not legal. So in Saskatchewan, we don't want to hear this story. My view is, I hope you hear it and tell your neighbors and friends in Saskatchewan, because we've got to break down these walls of denial about what we're doing, whether it's heavy oil and climate change or the nuclear fuel cycle in the weapons stream or tritium in Great Lakes. We've got to find ways to talk about what we're actually constructing and not hide behind our economic regional vested interests. And we got to find ways to talk across regions, because sometimes it isn't easy for people to hear up close, as the tar sands people or other people know, because they have a vested interest. Now, I'll end with the economics. It's pretty simple. In Ontario, they've built up a dependency on nuclear power, which is actually irrational, because nuclear power turns out to be the exact opposite of what you want for base load reliability. You want low cost, high performance for base load. You don't want high cost, low performance, which is what nuclear is. High cost, low performance. 8 nuclear power plants shut down from 1998 to 2004. Totally out of service. Why is that? Aging, safety, and that's built into the technology. When we've got the potential of conservation, reducing demand, massive potential. Stop using electricity for space heating and water heating. You'd reduce one-third of the demand on the Ontario grid. Irrational uses of electricity. So in other words, growth isn't always the answer. Reduction is possible. Quality of life doesn't correlate with more contamination. Quality of life actually might correlate with reduced contamination. I mean, I know it's hard for us to get our heads sometimes around this. The economics are clear. If you actually cost what nuclear power costs to produce electricity, and you take out all the pro-nuclear biases that the Ontario Power Authority uses, wind and gas are a third when you do full costing. Don't forget, there's all these unstated costs, like the debt in Ontario Hydro, $35 billion, the separate levy that the ratepayers pay, because if it was on their electrical bill, they'd rebel. So you don't want to go down this road. It's a myth and it's a bluff, and they're only here actually because they got huge subsidies anyway, and they're trying to get a toe in the door in Alberta, because you've been on this long pathway of energy growth, economic driven development, and you've clearly been conditioned to think that all benefits come from the growth in the energy sector. We know they don't. We know that what it does to the Athabasca River. We know that the wealth isn't distributed throughout society. We know people are going to be dealing with benzene in the water system for centuries. And some of these climate change scenarios, they'll probably breach the tailings dams that are right on the edge of the Athabasca River. That's the thing that makes me nervous when I see the pictures. Because don't forget, climate change is not the scenarios of water. Are not within the ones the engineers who are supposedly doing environmental protection operate in. They're operating in old-fashioned scenarios that are not going to be what the future is like. So in ending, not clean, not safe, not peaceful, and definitely not economic, but could be coming to Alberta. Figure out how that would be possible. And do what you can to raise awareness among the public and the politicians that the alternatives are blowing in the wind, coming from the sky, and it's better to get on track sooner with the conversion, because we could have done this in the 70s when the OPEC oil price crisis occurred. We didn't. I am ending. The nuclear power industry at that point said, you have to go nuclear or there will be a huge energy crisis. People put energy and time into nuclear in the 70s, and what did we end up with? We ended up with one quarter of the capacity that the industry said we'd need. We never needed it at all, but we lost time in the conversion. If we do it again, then we're just putting an even worse burden on the kids 20 years down the road. So let's do it right this time, and let's do it for people who will be thinking about us in the future and hopefully thinking fondly about us. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll all have lunch now, and I think we've got 15 minutes, and we'll start the question period.